own pulse quicken. He has a tiny temperature, that's all. 99 degrees. Really, Grace, I'm sure it's nothing. We'll keep on top of it. He might be getting a cold, but this could also be because he's excited that you're here. I see that sometimes, especially in patients who don't get a lot of visitors. Listen, she said, seeing the concern in my eyes. There are worse things than having your husband's heart beat faster when you come into the room, right? The only thing Roger does when I come home is snore. Either that or turn the volume up on the TV. If you think about it, this is actually a good sign. It means he knows you're here. Alicia said goodnight and told us to enjoy the movie. After she left, I continued the massage, stretching out Jamie's left arm and rubbing the muscles from wrist to shoulders. I worked in silence for a time, my eyes tearing up as I thought about what Alicia said. Had Jamie felt my absence this week? Did he feel my presence now? The possibility made me feel guilty and elated at the same time. Guilty because he might have thought I'd abandoned him, and elated because, if what Alicia said was true, it meant that he was still in there somewhere. Beyond food, water, warmth, and freedom from pain, the first and strongest desire we have is to be important to someone else, to be noticed. If you don't believe me, go to a park or a playground. Watch the children, from 3 on up, showing off for one another and for their parents, shouting, "Look at me, look at me." From the very first, back when no one else could see me or hear me, Jamie did. I moved to the other side of the bed and stretched out Jamie's right arm. Jamie, do you remember Mrs. Babcock, our civics teacher? She always wore that glittery peacock blue eyeshadow all the way up to her brows. You remember? Did I ever tell you about what she said to me just a couple months before graduation? I paused for a moment, as I always do, giving him space to respond. Well, she stopped me when I was coming out of the library and asked what I was going to do after graduation. I said, get a job, which seemed obvious to me. When that answer didn't seem to satisfy her, I told her I was saving up for a car, too. And then she said, Grace, listen to me. Instead of working to buy a car, invest in yourself. Use the money to take some classes at the community college. It's much less expensive than a university, and later, if you decide to get a 4-year degree, the credits will transfer. But even a 2-year associate's degree could make a big difference in your life and future. I told her I'd think about it, and she said she hoped I would, that I was a bright girl. Then she squeezed my shoulder and said, By the way, I don't know what you're doing, but whatever it is, keep on doing it. You look wonderful. I paused again, not to leave space for Jamie to respond, but because even now, after all this time, the memory stung. In the moment, I was happy, and of course I said thank you. Mrs. Babcock was a nice person, a good teacher. But later that night I started thinking, if I was so bright, why hadn't she said anything before? Why did I have to lose 50 pounds before she took the time to encourage me? And it wasn't just Mrs. Babcock. Before I lost the weight, everybody looked right through me, which was a pretty good trick considering how big I was. How ironic was it that the littler I got, the more people could see me? Except you. You were different, Jamie. And I loved you for it. I still do. I always will. I closed my eyes and kissed the top of his head, burying my lips in his thick brown hair, the one part of him that seemed undiminished since the fall. I see you, I whispered, lifting my head and looking into his vacant eyes. Can you see me? Because I miss that, Jamie. More than anything else, I miss being visible.
Chapter 18. Nan. You really can't appreciate how dependent you are on a limb until you've been denied the use of it. Without my right arm, I couldn't so much as style my hair properly or button my own blouse, let alone prepare for my Monday night support group and sewing session with Grace and Monica. Fortunately, Malcolm was around to lend a hand. 2 of them, actually. I was so grateful. His cooking skills weren't exactly advanced, but he drove me to the grocery store so I could buy fruit, crackers, pre-cut vegetables, and an assortment of fancy cheeses. With a little guidance from me, Malcolm mixed up a batch of delicious homemade hummus to be served with veggies. It wasn't a proper dinner, but no one would go hungry. And while I used my good arm to arrange the food on trays and added some parsley and a few edible pansies for garnish, Malcolm hauled my sewing machine and notions down from the guest bedroom. He was setting up the ironing board when I brought in a basket of crackers and put them down next to the cheese tray. "I set up 3 work areas," he said, casting his eyes around my huge oak dining table. "One for cutting, one for pinning, and one for sewing." "Thank you, Malcolm. This is perfect." "Good. Now I'll just get out of your hair before your friends arrive." "Are you sure you don't want to stay? We've got plenty of food." "No, no. This is your girls' night. You don't need me intruding. Besides, I need to get started on the evening round of walks." 2 dogs a session divided by 8 dogs, your 7 plus my steward, means I've got a good 2 hours of trekking ahead of me. But if you wouldn't mind saving me a bit of that cheese, I imagine I'll have an appetite when I get back."
"I will. I'll save some of everything."
Malcolm put on his coat and took 2 leashes down from the hook, one for Blixen and the other for Stuart, the shepherd mongrel mix that he had adopted as a puppy. Blixen and Stuart got up and walked to the door. We were all used to the routine by now. Malcolm arrived every morning at 8, by which time I would already have been down to the kennel to feed the dogs. With so many, I let only Blixen and Nelson sleep inside. He took them for walks, 2 by 2, then stuck around for an hour or two to help me with any errands or chores that needed doing. At 5, he would return and do it all again. Malcolm was truly a godsend. But it felt odd being so dependent on someone I didn't know well, even though I'd technically known him for years.
"You shouldn't have to do all this," I said, frowning at the top of Malcolm's gray head as he bent down to clip on Stuart's leash. "Maybe I should ask Chrissy to come."
Malcolm stood up, looking surprised and possibly a little hurt. Though I may have been reading things wrong, I'm a little out of practice when it comes to interpreting the expressions and actions of men.
"Well," he said, "if you'd rather have your daughter, I certainly understand. But if you're worried that you're imposing on my goodwill, don't. This is no hardship for me. I far prefer the company of dogs to people."
He smiled.
"Present company accepted."
Besides being out of practice when it comes to reading men, I was having a little trouble interpreting my own emotional responses, at least since Malcolm came on the scene. When he smiled, I became aware of a strange, anxious, sort of empty feeling in the pit of my stomach. The only thing I could liken it to was the way I'd felt when James and Layla, his wife, invited me along for a family vacation to Florida. I hadn't set foot on an airplane since Jim died. While waiting to board the flight, I started to feel very strange, almost lightheaded, and turned so pale that James insisted I sit down. The Xanax Layla gave me helped me make it through the flight, but I stared straight ahead the whole time, refusing to look out the window. Malcolm's smile made me feel like I did while I was waiting to get on the plane, but not quite. Maybe I was hungry, or maybe it was the pain pills Dr. Francatelli prescribed. I'd only taken them for 2 days, but still, you never knew how long these things stayed in your bloodstream.
"Well, I really don't think I could manage this menagerie without help. If you're sure you don't mind, Malcolm."
"I don't mind." I stood in the doorway watching as he walked down the garden path, following in Blixen and Stuart's eager footsteps. When they got to the gate, he turned to look at me and smiled. My stomach flew to Florida.
"Be still, Nelson. This will only take a minute."
I knelt on the floor, trying to get Nelson to hold still long enough so Monica could measure the distance between his neck and his rump.
We'd decided to make our own dog jacket patterns, using Blixen, Nelson, and Maisie as mannequins for the large, medium, and small-sized jackets. Getting Blixen and Maisie's measurements had been a piece of cake, but Nelson was feeling frisky and kept trying to lick my nose. "Stop it, you big goofball!" Nelson lunged at my nose again, and I started laughing, setting off Peaches and Cream, who began baying gleefully. "Grace," Monica called out over the din, "can you take over for Nan? The model's not being very cooperative." Grace, who had more experience designing garments than I did, not to mention the use of both arms, was sketching out the pattern for a Blixen-sized jacket on a piece of butcher paper. "Just 1 second." Grace erased a line and redrew it, then put aside her pencil and got down on the floor. "Uh-uh," she said when Nelson tried to lick her nose, too. "No kissing on the first date." She put a hand firmly on each of Nelson's shoulders. Perhaps sensing she meant business, he stopped wiggling long enough for Monica to get the measurements she needed. Peaches and Cream settled down, too, and we were finally able to get to work. While Grace quickly drew out the medium-sized pattern, I ironed the fabric to press out any creases, then pinned on the pattern pieces she'd already cut out. It wasn't easy with just one arm, but I managed. Monica was in charge of cutting. By the time she was finished, Grace was ready to start sewing, working so quickly that Monica and I had a hard time keeping up. But before long, we fell into a rhythm and were able to work and talk at the same time. "How are things working out with Malcolm?" Monica asked. "It's good, but odd. I'm out of the habit of conversing with humans," I said, and reached down to pat Blixen on the head. "He seems nice," Grace said, reaching for a piece of cheese while she waited for Monica to finish cutting the next jacket. "Oh, he is, and I'm grateful for the help. I couldn't possibly manage on my own, especially with 7 dogs in the house. That's a chore even with 2 good hands. And Malcolm is certainly less intrusive than Chrissy would have been." "Not exactly a ringing endorsement." Grace brushed cracker crumbs off the sewing machine. "Are you sure you don't want me to come and stay with you?" "Don't be silly. You're up to your earlobes as it is." "It's not as bad with Gavin out of town. I had to come into work on Sunday morning, but Gavin's flight took off at 2, so I spent the rest of the day with Jamie. Tonight I actually left the office at 6:30. Not early enough to go to Lansdowne before I came here, but still, it feels good to hop off the hamster wheel for a few days. And when your boss comes back, you'll have to hop right back on." Grace shrugged, but she didn't argue with me. If I had said I needed help, Grace would have found a way. So would Monica. Isn't it a shame that I had to turn 60 before I realized that the words best friend could be applied to creatures with 2 feet as well as 4? Monica and Grace were as loyal as any retriever on earth. They would do anything for me, and the feeling was mutual. Besides, I didn't mean that the way it sounded. Malcolm is a huge help, and we've known each other a long time, so it's not like we have to fill each other in on our life story. That's a relief. On the other hand, we have a lot in common, too, so there's plenty to talk about, if we feel like it. Malcolm's not one who has to talk just to fill the silence. I'm the same. Probably comes from spending so much time with the dogs, I said, as I laid a pattern onto a piece of red fabric with blue polka dots. Monica, who had just finished cutting out a jacket of blue chambray, handed the pieces to Grace and said, "So, if Malcolm were a dog, what breed would he be?" "What breed?" I laughed, intrigued by the question. "Let me see. Definitely a golden. He's calm, not easily ruffled, and goes with the flow. He's also pleasant, cheerful, and a good listener." "He's Blixen," I said. "No wonder I like him." "That means he's a perfect match," Monica said. "Your spirit animal. Now, what about this isn't working for you?"
"Nothing," I said. "It just feels funny, accepting help from someone else. But I guess I'm helping Malcolm, too.
I think Malcolm needs to feel useful.
Sounds like a good arrangement for everybody, Grace said.
Yes, I said, picturing Malcolm at the garden gate.
Yes, I think it is.
Well, I'm glad we got that settled, Monica said as she took the polka dot pattern from my hand and started cutting. Moving on. Are you still looking for fundraising ideas for the rescue?
Definitely,
I said. What did you have in mind? What about a fairy dog mother's ball? A dinner dance for pets and people?
That's an adorable idea. I love it. Would you do it at the restaurant?
I don't think the health department would allow it, Monica said. I was thinking we could have it here, in your garden. You've got so much space. We could invite more people that way, and it's always so pretty in summer.
It should be a costume party, Grace added, with prizes. Maisie and I will need matching outfits. I'm seeing pink tulle and sequins.
There's not enough tulle in Portland to make a costume for Desmond, Monica said, but I'll come up with something.
Monica, this is a brilliant idea. I bet we could raise $5,000 or $6,000 for Rainbow Gate.
Unable to contain my excitement, I jumped up from my chair and kissed Monica on the top of the head.
Hang on, hang on, Monica laughed.
Let's not start naming figures until I have some time to crunch the numbers and come up with a ticket price. I'll do the catering at cost, so that will help. And I'm sure I can get some of the vendors I work with to donate at least some of the food and rental equipment. If we have it in June, that should give us plenty of time to plan. And hopefully good weather.
Grace turned the jacket she'd finished sewing inside out and carried it to the ironing board to press the seams.
It really does sound like fun. But before we start talking menus and decor, I want to hear about Dr. Dreamboat.
Doctor who? I asked.
Dr. Dreamboat, Monica said. You don't remember? The ER doctor, Dr. Francatelli. You pinned the nickname on him right after you announced to everyone present, including the doctor, that I had a thing for Italian men.
Oh, no. Did I really?
Monica nodded.
I'm sorry. Those pain meds were too strong. I quit taking them.
It's okay, Monica shrugged. Mark has a good sense of humor.
Mark?
Grace asked. You're on a first-name basis?
Monica shrugged again, keeping her eyes on her work, but I could see a hint of a smile on her lips.
He came around to the restaurant the next day. I brought his dessert out myself, and we talked for a little bit, exchanged recipes. He likes to cook. And then I saw him again day before yesterday.
Grace and I exchanged a look.
He came to the restaurant looking for you twice in 1 week, I asked.
Sounds like things are moving quickly.
Not the restaurant, Monica said. I went to the ER on Saturday night. I had this weird rash on my arm.
Grace looked at her blankly.
You went to the emergency room for a rash?
Yes,
Monica said, frowning. WebMD had a picture of a rash that was just like mine. Exactly like mine. Do you know what it was? Scarlet fever. It could have been serious.
And was it?
Grace asked.
Monica's frown deepened. Her forehead pleated like a set of shutters.
No, she muttered. It was paprika.
Paprika?
I accidentally smeared some on my arm while I was experimenting with a new marinade, okay? But it could have been serious. Stop laughing. It's not funny.
One of Monica's many good qualities is that she can see the humor in almost any situation, even when the joke comes at her own expense. Even as she protested Grace's laughter, Monica's own mouth started twitching at the corners. But before her smile had fully bloomed, a cloud crossed over her face. She put down her scissors and hinged her head back, staring at the ceiling.
I already messed it up, didn't I? I ruined it before it even started.
She smacked her hand to her forehead.
What's the matter with me? Why do I always do this? And why with this one? He's gorgeous, and he's a doctor who likes to cook. And he's Italian. A gorgeous Italian doctor who likes to cook. Basically, he's perfect, she said,
still talking to the ceiling. And for a couple of minutes in the restaurant, when we were talking about cannoli fillings, we had a connection. He did like me. I could tell. But I had to ruin it, didn't I? Instead of keeping my crazy under wraps until he got to know me well enough to think I was adorable and eccentric instead of nuts, I had to go to the ER with my paprika emergency so Dr. Perfect Italian Dreamboat would know right off that I am a complete train wreck. Monica groaned. Alex said I'm too pushy, and he's right. He said I need to back off a little, give people space. But did I listen? No, of course not. I ruined everything before it even got started. Grace left the ironing board and went to sit down next to Monica. Oh, come on. It's not that bad. Maybe he thought you were just looking for an excuse to see him again and took it as a compliment. Maybe he thought it was cute. And it was, kind of. It's the kind of story that couples tell each other when they go out to dinner for their 10th anniversary. Grace lowered her chin and her voice, pretending to be Dr. Dreamboat. Honey, remember how you had such a crush on me that you smeared paprika on your arm and showed up in the ER just so you could see me? Yes, I chimed in. Grace is right. This is one of those things that will make a great family story someday. Not if I never see him again, Monica said glumly. I bet you anything he drops by the restaurant again next week. He'll come looking for you. And if he doesn't, well, then he just doesn't deserve you. If he can't recognize all of your wonderful qualities and laugh off a tiny touch of hypochondria, then it's his loss. Monica stared at me. Nan, did I ever tell you about how when I was in the fourth grade and everybody in the class got invited to Hillary Resnick's pool party but me? My mother gave me almost the exact same speech. It wasn't convincing then either. She heaved a sigh. Oh, well, I guess it was a little too soon to be measuring him for a tux and reserving the wedding chapel. I've only had 3 conversations with him. So what if he's a doctor, and Italian, and gorgeous, and likes to cook? That doesn't mean he's perfect, does it? Absolutely not, Grace replied. He might be one of those guys who sucks his teeth after he eats, or uses toothpicks. She made a face. I hate that. It's not quite as bad as flossing in public, but close. True, Monica said. He might be one of those guys who spends his entire weekend watching football, or 3 Stooges marathons. He might be a close talker, or flatulent. He might wear briefs instead of boxers. Monica looked to us for support. Am I right? Grace nodded. He might drive a car with those big, oversized tires. Or worse, I said. He might hate dogs. Yes, Monica said definitively, holding her hands sideways and chopping the air. Exactly. He might be any of those things, or all of them. I have no way of knowing. But there must be something wrong with him. Otherwise, why would a handsome Italian doctor who likes to cook still be single? Because he has flaws. Monica said, lowering her voice to an ominous register. Deep, dark flaws that aren't obvious at first glance, but they're there just the same. They must be. You know what? I feel better already. Clearly I dodged a bullet. Whew! Monica wiped imaginary sweat from her brow, picked up the scissors, and started cutting again. So, enough of my drama. Grace, how was your week? Up until yesterday, terrible. Being indispensable is exhausting, she said, sitting down in front of the sewing machine. I'm really looking forward to these next few days with Gavin out of town. Oh, and did I tell you what Alicia, one of Jamie's nurses, said? We shook our heads. Well, Jamie's pulse and temperature were a teensy bit elevated. Nothing to worry about. But Alicia thought it was because he knew I was there, and... Grace's cell phone rang, interrupting her story. She glanced at the screen and quickly picked up. Hello? Yes, this is Grace. She was quiet for a long while, listening to the voice on the other end of the line. From the look in her eyes, I could tell that it wasn't good news. Finally, she said, All right. Yes, I understand. Thank you, Doctor. I'll be right there.
Grace ended the call.
I have to go.
Monica handed Grace her purse. I got her coat from the closet.
Jamie?
I asked. Grace nodded as she slipped her arms into the sleeves of her coat.
His temperature spiked. They're going to take some x-rays, but the doctor thinks it's pneumonia.
Oh, no, Monica said.
Are you okay? Do you want us to come with you?
Grace either didn't hear or wasn't listening. She was already halfway out the door. Monica and I stood on the porch and watched her speed away. In the time that I'd known Grace, Jamie had gone through more than one health crisis. His condition meant he was fragile by nature, but somehow he always managed to hold on. Grace always said he was strong, a fighter who was determined to live. I was sure she was right. But no matter how strong the desire to live, death comes for us all in time. Though I hoped I was wrong, something in me sensed that Jamie's time had come.
Nan?
Monica's voice was uncharacteristically soft.
Do you pray?
Every day, I said, my mind turning to Danny.
How? I mean, do you need to say anything special? Read something?
I shook my head. I just pour it all out and then leave it in God's hands.
Does it work?
I don't always get what I ask for, if that's what you mean. Am I heard?
I believe I am.
Monica reached for my hand and closed her eyes. I did the same. We stood there like that for a long time, joined in a silent plea.
Chapter 19. Grace. Grace? I turned around and found myself being hugged by Mrs. Babcock. Her hair was gray and her face was lined, but she still wore the same peacock blue eyeshadow. It was a beautiful service, Grace. Thank you. Thank you for coming. I tried to draw back, but Mrs. Babcock didn't seem inclined to let go of me just yet. Over her shoulder, I made an apologetic face to Jerry, my father-in-law, whom I had been talking to before Mrs. Babcock approached. He shrugged to let me know it was fine, then walked off to join Penny, my mother-in-law, who was sitting in a corner, her eyes red from crying. I'm so, so sorry for your loss. Mrs. Babcock squeezed me much too tightly. I took a firm step backward so she'd have to release me. Thank you, I said again. Such a terrible thing. Pneumonia, wasn't it? That's what I heard. And after all he'd been through, she clucked her tongue. I hope, at least, that he went peacefully. He did, I said truthfully. I could have said more, and I expect that Mrs. Babcock wanted to hear more, but that wasn't information she was entitled to. In the 12 years of our marriage, Jamie and I had shared countless private and personal moments, but none more intimate than the moment of his death. For 6 days I sat by his bedside. Every day he grew weaker. Every morning, breathing was more of a struggle than the day before. On the final morning, when it became obvious that there was no hope, I asked the doctors to remove all the needles and tubes. I climbed into Jamie's bed and nestled close to him, lying on my side and stroking his hair, telling him one last time how much I loved him, how happy he had made me, promising him that I would be strong and fine and well, and that it was all right to go before me. As usual, Jamie was staring at the door, now closed to protect our privacy. Though I was lying right next to him, he didn't look at me or acknowledge my presence. Somehow I had thought, I had hoped he might. After all the months of worry and anguish, I hoped that at the end there might be some brief but miraculous reconnection with consciousness, a sign, and that Jamie would, if not speak, at least look at me in a way that let me know I had not failed him. It didn't happen. As the sun was beginning to set, he took a long, ragged breath and then released it slowly, along with his life. In those final seconds, an expression of peace and recognition spread across his face. He didn't bid me farewell in any sense that I could understand, but I knew that the one he had been watching for had come for him at last, and that was enough for me. The peace granted to Jamie lighted and lingered upon me as well. After so many months of struggle, we were able to rest at last. And then he was gone. I couldn't explain it to Mrs. Babcock, or to anyone, but it was the most intimate, sacred, and precious moment that Jamie and I ever shared. "Well, that's a mercy, at least," Mrs. Babcock said. "For both of you, I should think." "Excuse me?" "I'm just saying that it had to come as something of a relief. You've been so brave, Grace, but it had to be a burden. I mean, first the cancer and then this?" I felt my jaw clench. Jamie was never a burden to me. Never. "No, no," she clucked. "Of course not. But now, after all this time, Jamie is at peace and you can move on with your life, poor darling." She shifted her weight in my direction, as if she were about to hug me again. I took another step backward. "Excuse me, but I think my in-laws need me. Thank you again for coming." "Of course, of course," she said. "I just wanted to say hello and tell you how sorry I was. You run along and take care of your family." She reached out and grabbed my hand. "But, Grace, can I just say how wonderful you look? It's amazing the way you've been able to keep the weight off for all these years. When I think about that fat little girl who used to sit in the back row of my classroom, always dressed in black and too shy to speak, working so hard to be invisible, even though she was as big as..." "Mrs. Babcock, I really have to go." "Oh, yes, sorry. I didn't mean to keep you. It's just so good to see..." I pulled my arm from her grip and walked away. The crowd was starting to thin out, and I was glad of it. I couldn't ever remember being as exhausted as I was at that moment. My encounter with Mrs. Babcock had sucked up the last drops of energy remaining in me. How in the world did the tradition of post-funeral receptions ever begin, anyway? As if funerals weren't draining enough, somebody decided that the bereaved family members should host a party after? It wasn't all bad. I hadn't been home in almost 2 years, so it was nice to see my little brothers, Tommy and Skip, and my cousins, and it was good to talk to some of our old classmates and share Jamie's stories. Until Mike Zimmerman sought me out, I'd never heard the one about how he and Jamie had driven Mike's beat-up goner of a Chevy, a rust bucket he'd named Captain America, into the river one night, just to see what it felt like to escape from a sinking vehicle. "Teenage boys are such a bunch of knuckleheads," Mike said. "But Jamie was the worst of all. Thought he was invincible. But I'll tell you, after he beat the cancer and then survived that fall, I kind of thought it might be true." "Me too," I said, smiling wetly but keeping my emotions in check, because by that point I didn't even have enough energy to cry. But Mike did it for me and hugged me even longer and tighter than Mrs. Babcock had. I let him. That was a good conversation, a story I would treasure, and there were many more besides. But I also had to endure a number of less lovely exchanges with people who, though less directly than Mrs. Babcock, hinted that Jamie's death must have come as a relief. They had no idea what they were talking about. And though I love my in-laws, Jamie and I lived in an apartment over their garage for 6 years before we moved to Portland, it was hard to see them grieving. Penny was a wreck, had sobbed through the whole service. I felt terrible for her, and for Jerry. After surviving cancer, Jamie worried about what he might be passing on to a potential child, so we put off the idea of having kids for a few years after we were married. Considering how young and broke we were, it was probably just as well. Later, we were so busy working and going to school that we put it off again. With Jamie only a year away from finishing his paramedic training, the time finally seemed right to think about starting a family. We'd discussed it just a couple of weeks before Jamie's accident and decided to start trying for a baby in the fall. I'd thought about that a lot, especially in the last few days. If we'd never gone on that camping trip for our anniversary, if it hadn't been raining so hard, if Jamie hadn't tried to be a hero, if... I might be the mother of a chubby-cheeked one-year-old. How would I feel if that baby, my only son, was taken from me? What special brand of grief accompanied the misfortune of outliving your child? I didn't know. But as I thought about the baby and what might have been, and now never would be, I could imagine. Accepting brief condolences from the few remaining guests along the way, I crossed the room to check on my in-laws. When I sat down next to her, Penny looked at me with tear-stained cheeks and hollow eyes. The look on her face was heartbreaking. I reached out to hug her. The tears I was sure had run dry began flowing again. I'm sorry, Mom. Honey, you stop that now. What have you got to be sorry about? I don't know. I feel like I should have... Should have what? Never left Minnesota? Stopped Jamie from being Jamie? You could no more do that than keep the earth from spinning. You were a good wife to my boy. You stood by him when everyone else had gone. You made him so happy and supported him every minute. Nobody could have taken better care of him. Not even me. She looked up at Jerry, who was standing behind her chair. Now, Gracie, you know Penny well enough to know that it just makes her teeth hurt to admit that, he said, smiling through a sheen of unshed tears. I sure wish we'd been able to come and help you at the end, but... I reached for Jerry's hand. You drove out at Christmas. I was so happy you did. Me too, he said. Helped a lot to see what a nice place it was. Even if we'd had the money, we couldn't have gotten Jamie the kind of care he needed, not way out here in the country. I know how hard you had to work, keeping him there. I'm just sorry we couldn't help more. But since we lost the farm... I know, Dad, I said, and squeezed his hand. I know. We all did the best we could. Penny sniffled. I pulled a tissue out of my pocket and handed it to her. She dabbed at her eyes. I know he's in a better place now, but it seems so unfair that he's gone. It just makes me feel sad. But then I remember that we almost lost him once before. I remember when you and Jamie got married. You were wearing a blue dress with little yellow flowers. And Jamie was wearing a yellow dress shirt, I said. Penny bobbed her head, confirming my recollection, and smiled a little. Between the family and all the nurses who wanted to be there for the wedding, I bet there were 40 people crammed into that hospital room. Jamie was skinny and pale, not a hair left on his head because of the chemo. But he was grinning from ear to ear, she said, as a tear rolled down her cheek. He was so happy. I remember thinking that he was never going to leave that hospital room. But I was wrong. He got 13 more years, and we got the chance to see Jamie grow up, fulfill his dreams, and find love. He'd never have found the strength to do that without you, Gracie. Penny gazed up at her husband. Do you remember, honey? It was everything we prayed for when he was so sick. In lots of ways, we were blessed, weren't we? Jerry nodded and laid a big working man's hand on her shoulder. He was a good son, a good man. And you've been a good daughter, Grace. We couldn't have asked for better. After giving Jerry and Penny another hug, I excused myself and went to the bathroom to splash some cold water on my face, an attempt to rally the energy to endure a final hour of condolences before driving back to Minneapolis. I had to catch an early flight to Portland the next day. Mike and a couple of Jamie's old friends had urged me to stay an extra day. They wanted to take me to dinner. But the funeral and final medical expenses had wiped out what little was left of my savings, so I needed to get back to work. Exiting the ladies' room, I spotted a woman with white hair kneeling in front of my mother-in-law, holding the leash of a silken-coated golden retriever. The dog's muzzle was resting in Penny's lap, and she was stroking its head and nodding in response to the woman's murmured conversation. Nan? She turned around, then got to her feet and started walking toward me. What are you doing here? I told you that you didn't need to come. I know, but I wanted to. Malcolm is taking good care of the other dogs, including your Maisie. She opened her one good arm to embrace me. I'm so sorry we missed the service. There was some kind of mechanical problem in Portland, and our flight was delayed. You flew here? You hate flying. But I love you. And Blixen was with me, so that helped, she said, smiling at her dog, who was sticking close to Penny. I thought it would be good to bring him. I thought he might be a comfort. Penny stopped petting Blixen and looked up at me, her eyes still sad, but dry and calm. A brief bout of lightheadedness reminded me that I'd forgotten to eat that morning, so while Nan and Blixen made rounds among the mourners, I visited the buffet table. There wasn't much left by that time, just some cheese and crackers, deviled eggs, a little potato salad, and a few brownies. My mother, who had been talking to the minister, walked over when she saw me putting food on a plate. Are you sure you want all that? All what? I asked, looking at my plate. It held 2 pieces of cheese, 4 crackers, 1/2 a deviled egg, 1 tablespoon of potato salad, and a brownie. The only thing I've had today is coffee. Well, she said grudgingly, just so you don't start channeling your grief into food. I'm just saying you had to work so hard to take off the weight. It'd be a shame if you gained it all back. So many do. The people on that show, the one where they go to that camp and compete to lose all that weight. I read a story just last week saying the winners almost always gain it back. Mom, I'm not going to gain back the weight. I've kept it off for 13 years. I know, she said, watching nervously as I ate a piece of cheese. I'm just saying people do. And you've been through a terrible loss. You holding up okay, Grace? I nodded. I'm fine. It's been hard, but I'm fine. Good. She put her arm around my waist. You've been so brave, honey. When Jamie had his accident, I didn't think you'd be able to cope, but you did, and I'm real proud of you. You took good care of him. My mother, a glass-half-full person who believed it was important to keep her children from getting a big head, was never one to throw away compliments, so her comments surprised me. I was a little curious to know why she thought I might not be able to cope, but decided I was better off not knowing. Thanks, Mom. So what are you going to do now? Well, I said, my flight leaves out of Minneapolis at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, so I hope I can get on the road before dark. I'd like to get at least a few hours of sleep. There's a little bit of paperwork I still need to do to get the ashes shipped out to me. She tilted her head far to the right. Shipped? Do you mean you're not going to bury them here?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't think that's what Jamie would want. I talked it over with Penny and Jerry, and they agree.
My mother set her mouth, the way she always does when she's irritated with something I've done. Growing up, I saw that look on her face at least twice a day, sometimes more. It got to the point where I realized that her expression wasn't even necessarily related to my actions. Sometimes my mere existence irritated her. That hurt. I won't pretend that it didn't. When I was a kid, I wanted nothing more than to please my mother, but somehow I never could. Jamie said that it wasn't me, it was my mom, that she was the kind of person who just couldn't be pleased with anyone. It wasn't until Jamie and I moved into that little apartment over his folks' garage and I saw firsthand how a happy family operates that I realized he was right. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't Mom's either. She wasn't wired for happiness.
Grace, she said impatiently, answer my question. What are your plans? When are you coming home?
Home? You mean back to Minnesota?
Mom, I'm not.
My job is in Portland now.
And your family is here. She clicked her tongue and set her mouth yet again. For heaven's sake, Grace, you can always find another job. Family is irreplaceable.
I looked at my mother, the thin woman with the thin smile and the unhappy heart. Then I looked across the room at Nan, whose heart was infinite, who took in strays of all kinds, 4- and 2-legged, and nurtured by nature, who had swallowed back her greatest fear to fly halfway across the country so I would know she cared. And I realized that my mother was right. Family, wherever you may find it, is irreplaceable.
I'll call you when I get to Portland. I'll be out to visit at Christmas.
I leaned forward and kissed her on the cheek.
I love you, Mom.
Chapter 20. Grace. We hit some mild turbulence on the flight back to Portland, when deep breathing didn't do the trick,
Nan, clutching at the armrest, asked me to talk to her.
About what?
Anything. I need a distraction. Tell me what you're working on.
This?
I asked, looking at the pile of blue and green patches I'd piled on the tray table.
It's just another quilt block.
It's pretty, Nan said, even though her eyes were screwed shut. Tell me about it. What's the pattern?
Well, I think it's actually called Amy's Choice, I said, but I've decided to call it Hero Star. I'm making it with scraps of Jamie's old EMT uniform. He was already working as an emergency medical technician back in Minnesota. He saved the lives of at least a dozen people, probably more.
I didn't know that, Nan said, opening her eyes. I nodded. Originally, even before he got sick, he wanted to be a doctor. He was one of those people who liked helping other people. But he lost a couple of years to cancer. Then his dad needed help on the farm.
Nan released her grip on the armrest and laid her hand on my forearm, but didn't interrupt my story. After a few years, Jamie decided he didn't want to wait anymore, so he signed up for EMT training at the community college. He loved the job, but could only get part-time work in our area, and after a while, he decided he really wanted to become a paramedic in a city setting. I smiled. We closed our eyes and stuck a pin in a map to decide where we were going to move for his paramedic training. But I'm pretty sure he peaked. He'd been talking about Portland all along. Mild winters, lots of recreational opportunities. At first, I wasn't so sure about moving. I'd never lived anywhere else, and I'm not as adventurous as Jamie. He had to talk me into it, but I'm glad he did. I'm glad he got to do some of the things he wanted to do with his life.
Me too, Nan said. But what do you want to do with your life?
I shrugged. Live, work, same thing I've always done. I mean, I'd like to find another job at some point, something with a slightly less miserable schedule. But I'll be back at the office tomorrow morning.
Nan frowned. Are you sure that's a good idea? Maybe you should take some time off, give yourself time to mourn and consider your future before diving back into business as usual.
I couldn't even if I wanted to. I'm out of vacation days. Plus, I've got bills to pay. Besides, I've been mourning for almost 2 years. Don't worry. I'm fine. Really.
The plane hit a little bump. Nan let out a little yelp and clutched at the armrest again, her knuckles turning white. Blixen, who was lying quietly on the bulkhead floor and wearing her service dog vest, put her muzzle on Nan's shoe.
"Should I ask the flight attendant to get you some tea?" I asked.
"Vodka tonic," Nan said. "Make it a double." The next day, I woke up at 5 as usual. But since I didn't need to go to Lansdowne before work, I decided to take Maisie for a walk and stop by Starbucks for a latte, hoping it would perk me up a little. When I passed the big cement planters where Sunny and Z hung out, Sunny nodded toward my extra-giant coffee cup and said, "Venti size. Did you win the lottery or something?"
"If only," I said, feeling a little guilty. Maybe I should have bought 2 smaller coffees and given one to Sunny. Since I'd gotten to know Sunny and Z better, I sometimes brought extra food at the grocery store and gave it to them on my way home. They were always very appreciative, high as kites half the time, but always polite. When I first moved to town, I'd been shocked by the number of people living on the streets, but I'd gotten used to it. I couldn't do much to tackle the problem of homelessness, but I could help Sunny and Z, or I could try to. But it was hard to predict if I would find them at home or out doing something else, finding a fix, riding the bus to stay warm. "I decided to treat myself," I said, feeling stupid, like I was making excuses. Sunny nodded dully and slid down to sit on her haunches. As she did, the hem of her dirty gray sweatshirt caught against the wall and rode up to expose a sliver of 2 pale flesh. That's when I realized that something wasn't right. The red wagon was missing. So was one of the sleeping bags, and Sunny looked worse than I'd ever seen her.
"Where's Z?"
"Gone," she said, her eyes glazing over as she stared past my legs.
"Gone where?"
Sunny shrugged. "Woke up 3 days ago and he was just...
gone. So was all his stuff. And the dog. She reached out to pat Maisie on the head. Hey, little girl. Maisie licked her dirty hand. I squatted down on the pavement.
You okay? Is there anything I can do?
Do you have any money? The way she asked quickly, so quickly, and with her eyes suddenly glittering and hungry, made me uncomfortable. I knew that Sunny and Z panhandled to survive, but they'd never directly asked me for a handout. Whether that was because it felt awkward to ask for money from someone who lived right in the neighborhood, or because I didn't look like somebody who had any, was hard to say.
I don't have any cash, I said truthfully.
But here. I held out my latte. Sunny stared at the cup.
Go ahead, I urged. It'll warm you up.
Are you sick or anything?
Totally healthy, I assured her.
She sniffled and swiped at her nose with her sleeve.
Okay, thanks.
I watched her drink, feeling better but worse, wishing I could do more but having no idea what more might be. Finally, I stood up.
You going to be okay?
Yeah, sure, Sunny shrugged. I miss the dog. But Z's just a guy. I can always find another one, right?
You think so?
Sunny held the cup close to her chest, as if trying to warm her entire body from that one small source of heat. No, but it makes me feel better to say so. All of my bosses, including Gavin, were attending an off-site meeting, so the office was quiet and I was grateful, thinking I'd need a day to catch up. But when I actually started sorting through my email and inbox, there wasn't all that much that needed doing. Gavin had a habit of piling stuff on my desk and attaching yellow sticky notes with terse instructions on each item, telling what he wanted done and when. But the pile he'd left for me was uncharacteristically short, consisting of nothing more than some filing and copying, plus a reminder to schedule a tune-up for his Lexus and an executive physical for himself. Apparently, Gavin had more of a heart than I'd given him credit for. I'd have to thank him when I saw him, then assure him that I was ready to get back to work. Honestly, I'd have preferred it if he'd heaped my desk with things that needed doing. It would have made the day easier to endure, kept my mind from thinking about Jamie, from trying to imagine how I was going to fill the remainder of my days and years and life without him. I made a lot of trips to the bathroom that day, closing myself in a stall to shed a few quiet tears before wiping my eyes with the tissue and going back to my desk. I did spend a little time updating my resume. I wasn't planning to look for another job right away, but I wasn't planning on spending the rest of my life being indispensable to Gavin Nutting either. He definitely wasn't my dream boss, but after he'd endured my unexpected leave of absence during Jamie's illness, it didn't seem fair to leave him high and dry. I'd ease out over the next few months, making sure I found a great replacement. There was no rush. At 3 o'clock, I went down to Starbucks for my usual small drip coffee. While I was waiting in line, someone tapped me on the shoulder. When I turned around, Luke Pascal was standing there, holding a bouquet of grocery store carnations and daisies. "Don't worry, I'm not staying," he said. "But I saw Monica yesterday and she told me about Jamie. I just wanted to tell you how sorry I am for your loss." He handed me the flowers. I briefly buried my face in the blossoms, breathing in the spicy, sweet scent of carnations.
"Thanks, Luke. That was nice of you. Do you have time for a cup of coffee?"
"Yes, but are you sure? I don't want to be accused of stalking."
"It's okay. Besides, I just this minute remembered that I forgot to give Monica the $16 I owe you."
"Yeah, well, I didn't want to say anything, but..." He coughed deliberately, then grinned. Smiling, I walked up to the checkout register.
"Two medium drip of the day." I turned to Luke. "How do you take it?"
"Black with 3 sugars.
"3?
"Don't judge." I ordered 2 oatmeal cookies in addition to the coffee. When we sat down at a table near the window, I handed 1 cookie to Luke, then took the other for myself and broke it in half, wrapping the leftover piece in a napkin. It wasn't until I slipped it into my purse that I felt Luke's eyes on me.
"Why do you do that?"
"Do what?" "Oh, this?" I asked,
glancing at the cookie half. It's kind of a habit. I was overweight growing up, really fat, and completely miserable. I tried dieting, but it just didn't work for me. I love to eat too much. Cutting out my favorite foods wasn't a realistic option for me, but portion control was. When I ate out, I started dividing everything I ate in half, saving the rest for another meal. That, along with the addition of regular walking and a few more green vegetables, did the trick.
You didn't cut the portions in half at the fish house. You ate everything. In fact, and don't take this the wrong way, but I was kind of impressed. I'd never seen anyone eat that many oysters.
Oh, well, oysters are kind of a weakness of mine. I broke a corner off my cookie. That along with everything else. No kidding, I really do love to eat. Most of the time I work hard not to overdo it. But the fish house was an exception. A special occasion.
Luke lifted his brows. Yeah? What was so special?
Monica was paying.
Luke's laugh was more like a deep bark, a cross between an enthusiastic seal and a big dog.
I'm sorry, he said, when I didn't join in.
Don't be, I said, forcing a smile. I meant it to be funny.
Luke sipped his coffee. So, how are you holding up?
I'm fine, really, I said, responding to his doubtful look. Nan came to the funeral. That helped a lot.
She's your other support group buddy, right? Monica has talked about her. She sounds pretty cool.
She is, I confirmed. And she's more than a buddy. She's my friend. I'm not sure that I understood what being a friend really meant, and how important it is to have them, until now. Nan's husband was killed in a plane crash, so she's terrified of flying. She flew all the way out to Minnesota anyway, because she thought I might need her. Turns out I did, even more than I knew. But that's Nan. She's so tuned in, so wise. She'd hate hearing me say that, but it's true. And it's not just because she's older. Nan and my mom are about the same age. But my mom... I shook my head. Well, let's just say that age and wisdom don't necessarily go hand in hand. But Nan seems to know what I need almost before I do. She never talks at me or lectures. Sometimes she asks questions, but mostly she just listens. And yet, without saying a word, she's able to make me understand where I'm going wrong.
She sounds like more than your friend. She almost sounds like your guru.
Oh, she'd really hate hearing that, I said, smiling. But you might be right. Anyway, it was so good to look up and see her there. It helped a lot. And the funeral did, too, in a way, hearing everybody tell their Jamie stories. It was good to know that other people have good memories of him, too. But, I sighed, it's good to be home. This has been such a long road.
I was surprised when Monica said you were going back to work already, Luke said. You sure you don't need some time?
Time for what? To sit home and be miserable? It's better to keep busy, you know? Get back into a routine.
I bit into my cookie. It tasted like sawdust. Sawdust and raisins.
Hey, do you have the time? Gavin's at an off-site meeting, but I shouldn't stay away from the office too long.
Luke frowned. You still didn't get a new battery for your watch? I opened my mouth and started to make up a story, a lie. But I just didn't have the energy for it, or the inclination. I didn't want to lie to Luke.
And, for some reason, I wanted him to know the story. I wanted him to understand. It's not the batteries. It's broken.
Jamie gave me this watch, an anniversary present, when we went on our last camping trip together, hiking in the North Cascades. It was drizzling when we started out in the morning, but the rain wasn't that bad. We'd seen worse. But after we stopped for lunch, it really began to pour, and the wind was blowing so hard it sounded like a freight train. I'd never seen rain like that. We decided it was too dangerous to keep going, so we turned around, started back down the mountain. But about halfway down, I slipped and fell over a steep embankment and twisted my ankle. Jamie climbed down to get me. I told him not to, that I thought I could crawl back up, but he didn't listen. He wasn't being stupid. Jamie was a good outdoorsman and always carried rescue gear in his pack. He tied a rope around the trunk of a good-sized tree and came down to get me. On another day, if it hadn't been raining so hard, it would have been no problem. But it was pouring, just pouring, and the ground was sodden.